Welcome to Catholic Stuff You Should Know, the J10 Initiative.
Hello, welcome back to Catholic Stuff You Should Know. Deacon Jacob here. I think there's two or three more episodes, Father, before it becomes Father.
Hey! Jacob.
So Deacon Jacob here with Father Mike.
You can hear my confession. Should I be your first confession?
If you want. Don't go sinning just so you
Nobody
have to.
Claimed it?
Yeah.
Trust me. I got plenty at any given time.
No, but nobody's claimed it. Nobody's asked. I've ignored most requests around ordination. I already turned down two requests to cover masses shortly after I'm again.
Yeah, come on, dog.
Like, I don't know what my life's going to look like. Don't know what my schedule... I was scheduling... I'm going to go out a weekend right after ordination to my grandma's small town in Oregon.
Cool.
And where my parents met. And I think... I will celebrate a mass out there, which is going to be really cool because growing up, we'd go out there for Christmas. We'd go out there for Easter sometimes. And being able to go back to celebrate a mass there is going to be pretty cool.
That's great.
But I didn't know, like, I wanted to do that. I didn't know what days that would work with. And so I turned...
Is she one of your Catholic heroes?
My grandma? Mm. Oh, yeah. She's, well, we call her Amuma, which is Basque, the Basque for grandma.
Amuma.
She turned 90 this past, right around Thanksgiving this past year. So 90 years old, stubborn Basque woman. Just that's where I get it. So she's definitely a prayer warrior. My grandpa was very faithful as well, kind of rocks, and she still prays for me daily.
I think Ignatius and Xavier, are they Basque?
Yeah, they are from... he's from Loyola, which is in the Basque country, and I'm pretty sure Ignatius at least is part Basque, if not entirely. And Xavier as well.
I went to Loyola, and I remember signs being in some language that I didn't understand.
Oh, yeah. It's totally... It's not like any of the Spanish dialects. It's not Catalan or Castilian. It's just its own language that predates the Spanish language, the Latin languages. So, north on the Pyrenees, doing the Camino with Father Sean in the summer. We're doing 10 days of it, not the whole way. And most of the Camino routes go through the Basque country or parts of it.
Cool.
I was pulling for the coastal route because it would be all Basque territories, those fishing villages and whatnot. We're doing the kind of the more main Camino Francais, the main route. But yeah, through some of the Basque territories. And then
doesn't that start on the coast?
The Francais? I think so.
Saint-Jean, Pied de Port?
In France, and then it kind of
or
goes
it might just be right at the
San Sebastian.
Base of the Pyrenees.
Down, but...
This is Father Mike.
If you didn't know,
I'm already a priest. I'm going to take those masses that...
Yeah, I sent him your number. I actually have it forwarded.
I make no promise. I make no promise.
I will soon generously offer to cover, but not yet.
I think that's prudent. I think that's wise.
I do have actually have one friend's wedding coming up as a deacon. So that'll be the last wedding I think I do as a deacon, and then I have another friend who's getting married a week after I'm ordained, so because she's a old friend, Alyssa, old friend from Denver here, and so yeah, we're kind of like the last two from our post-college friend group.
Nice.
Kind of entering into our vocations, and so it'll be cool. I'll be ordained, and then the next week I'll just can celebrate but be at the wedding mass.
Cool.
Which will be cool. So
well, tragically, we're getting close to the end of the line of our 3 month, 4 month.
Yeah, there's so much still to talk about. No, we still got all of April. Two more in April.
And I see soon to be, well, Reverend Mister for now, Machado. I see him so regularly, you know.
At the seminary.
Hopefully you don't get assigned in Mozambique.
Yes. Unfortunately, we have not annexed the Diocese of Mozambique to Denver yet. Not our territory.
Fortunately, because I get to keep you around.
It is exciting. A lot of people ask me, well, where are you going? And people who don't know the inner workings of the church or aren't Catholic, where are you going? You go anywhere in the world, right? Because the church is universal. The church is all over. So you can, and I'm like, no, diocesan priest tied to a territory, tied to the diocese. And then I tell them what the diocese boundaries are. And it's most of the north half of Colorado, which is huge territory-wise. And they're like, whoa, that's... You could be up near Wyoming? I was like, yeah, it could be.
Yeah. The What do you think about the experience? It's an entirely different experience. The Protestant pastors, a lot of Protestant denominations, have you interview and kind of pursue your own, you know, interests of which church to serve and hiring process and resume and all this stuff. Do you think you have an impressive resume, or would you give a good interview?
No, probably not. I don't think I'd be hired anywhere. Here, listen to these podcasts.
Some
I did
of some
Father Mike
group.
And yeah, if you, I guess if you need a priest, we'll hire you.
Hey, look, you said there's a lot of masses to cover. So here's a plug. All you young, single men out there who have a vocation to priesthood but are afraid to pursue it, you better go and visit a nearby seminary. And just once you got to step foot, you have the courage, go step foot in the seminary, go and talk to some people, and then you might find that's very delightful and a nice home, and that you can go and talk to a local vocations director. Try to get more priests there.
Do it.
Little plug.
Go. So we had our, this is total tangent, but I thought it was funny, and I'm going to bring it up to you. We had our coffee house at the seminary, which is kind of a little talent show once or twice a year, and a couple of the guys did a funny skit, almost like a Weekend Update type of thing.
Oh, right.
And
SNL.
Because Father John is the vice rector, they razzed us a bit with the podcast. And so,
oh, is that right? Thanks a lot, guys.
So this one, their line, their joke in a Weekend Update style was, the consciously unprofessional Catholic Stuff You Should Know podcast recently celebrated 14 years. In order to celebrate this historic achievement and to honor their devoted fans, hosts are thinking of changing the name of their podcast to Catholic Stuff You've Probably Already Heard Before. Or I personally think another good option would be Catholic Stuff You Can Maybe Figure Out If You Buy a Dictionary and Look Up the Big Words podcast.
go to Wikipedia.
So that's...
I like it, guys.
Riley Helgo, razzing us there. Dave Naprakowski as well. Don't worry, this podcast, we're going to use very small words for you.
So. Whatever. I babble.
No, I thought that was fun. There's a good spirit at seminary. We can laugh at ourselves. So, and it wasn't malicious, but
it's worth making fun of.
I thought it was worth bringing up because I laughed. Father John was laughing, and I thought listener land could laugh at that.
It's going to be viral.
Yeah, I don't know. Anything else going on? We've been chatting for an
I don't
hour.
Know about I don't talents. I kind of have run out. I don't really, I don't know banter-wise. You got a cool hat. I am wondering if other states take as much pride in their state.
Flag as we do.
You have so many people wearing t-shirts, hats, everything Colorado.
Yeah, I've got this, it's red, blue, and yellow. It's like super bright Colorado.
Primary colors.
Hat. We went on the hut trip, the seminary hut trip I was leading, and my favorite hat, it actually says, I'm so alive, my phone is dead, and on the front of it, which is a great adventure hat from a song. My friend John Paul Von Arx, JP Von Arx, he had this song called Cell Phone Blues, and that's kind of the refrain. I'm so alive, my phone is dead.
It's beautiful.
So shout out to John Paul. But I loved that hat, and I had lost it. I found it since. So I need a new hat.
Did you throw a party like the
I
lady
did. I
the,
invited everybody. Come celebrate. I found my hat. Yeah, so I got this one. It's very bright. You definitely weren't going to lose me out in the wilderness.
It's
with
cool.
This one.
You're always cool.
I think I walked into a tea shop, capital T, to buy some loose leaf tea. And the tea rista, as they call themselves,
nice.
She was she kind of looked up. And I'm wearing a Roman collar and this very bright Colorado hat. And she, I don't know if she knew what to do with me or not, but she just like grinned.
Did she guess a tea? She's like, that guy.
He's definitely going to be drinking, I don't know, jasmine spice, white tea, something. But no, she gave me some good suggestions. I've been a tea drinker more than coffee recently.
Is that? So, what about celestial seasonings?
So that's... I love Celestial Seasonings. They're a local spot. I love doing the tour, going into the mint room. I actually really like their teas, but that's all I've been drinking for 4 years.
Oh.
Because it's what we got at the seminary and whatever.
Sleepy time, dude.
So sleep time's great. I'm getting loose leaf tea because I wanted to change it up.
And because you're a hipster.
And because I'm a hipster. I got to tell you, though, I got this super cool German-engineered tea steeper. And it you put the loose leaf tea in, and then you fill the water up. It steeps, and then you set it on your mug, and the pressure pushes up this plate, and then it just drains straight into your cup. And it's so cool.
And it's meant to just be fun cool, or is it like...
I'm sure there's a reason it's better. It definitely gives
sort of slow brews.
So one of the other things in tea is you can get these little steeper balls, and you put the tea in.
Yeah, yeah.
But the problem with that is it doesn't let the tea leaves unfold and expand fully. So when you have a teapot that has a strainer in it or something like this that I got, lets the tea unfold and flower a little more.
Whoa, so nice.
Tea stuff you should know.
Yeah, well, I want to try some of that now.
But what I love on a kind of practical, spiritual level, I've been able to slow down, and instead of just grabbing the tea kettle as it boils and throwing the tea bag in the travel mug and out the door, I've actually, set up, steep the tea, pour it, sit down. I have a little bit of time. I'm waiting. It's become a little more meditative,
yeah.
A little more pause in the day. And then the afternoon, I usually make myself a cup, and that's been a great place to like pause between seminary classes and seminary life. I get back to the house, make a little pot of tea, kind of buffer between, and then I get back into study after kind of an intentional slowdown pause. So
you might have to teach me this though, because I could use pauses. I like that idea.
I'm trying to
it's
build
just human.
Them in. Yeah,
it's refreshing.
So we're just running from one thing to the next, and I realized I might have brought this up in another podcast because I've been telling a lot of people about it. But I was praying. I think it was the last podcast with you, or two ago. I was praying with Jesus on the way, Jesus on the road.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And that he lets himself be interrupted.
Mm.
And he's walking and he's teaching. And it happens on the way. And then there's these interruptions and there's just this space that's created. And so for me, instead of running from one thing to the next, I'm trying to create places of reflection, places where I can slow down, places where I can reset rather than just kind of jumping on the avalanche of the day at 6 a.m. and then hoping I survive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know that all too well. Well, I'll have you teach me. I'm not ready to invest in this whole process yet.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sophisticated yet.
Much more simple ways, but I will.
But I'm going to start with this celestial seasoning.
There you go.
Until I get tired of it. And then,
start with the intentionality of steeping it for the proper time instead of leaving it in for 15 minutes and making your tea very bitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it prescribed on the box or anything?
Yeah, I think on each of the bags it says 3 to 5 minutes or 2 to 3, whatever. Different teas have different steeping time. So I know you're riveted.
Hey, I like this. I do like anything that's a good meditation pause. Yeah. And then tea is just fantastic.
Yeah, it's so good. I like...
And right here, look, I mean no insult, but just a little. Father Jason Wunsch makes the tea, makes the coffee here. And I'll do the coffee in the morning, but it is jet fuel. Man, it is way thick and acidic and everything. And
wired for the day.
I need to switch over.
So, brings us to contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on my transitions into our topics.
Yeah, so. Great. A few more hormones, I think.
Bad joke. All right, back on track.
Sorry.
Some of the response we got from Father Sean's maybe foolhardy request for topics, because we were inundated and we're not going to be able to get to all of them. But I love that people are listening and really want their questions answered and just thinking well about life and how to engage the Catholic life daily.
A lot of cool questions.
Intentional life, and so even just like the intentionality of creating spaces to think, to pray, to have conversations, whatever it may be. I love that you guys are thinking that way. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions came in about kind of contemplation in general. And we're not necessarily going to do a full podcast on this, more of a conversation for you, but he just said, I'd love to hear more about the contemplative life, its history, saints, contemplative saints, different types, whether, Trappists or Carmelites, hermits, Eastern, Byzantine, Desert Fathers, Roman contemplatives, and then our own experience with the contemplative life, contemplative monasteries. And then what got me thinking, he says, how can lay people support or interact? And then I just want to tie that one in with a question we got was, does the church want married parents, families, around in the church. So, you know, for Paul in the Corinthians talks about like, oh, I wish you could all be, you know, live the life like I am, but I guess, yeah. I guess get married if you want to.
Or go to a monastery.
Yeah, that's usually how it's read, a little bit on the negative side. But, and then also there's an apparent lack of parent saints or married saints.
Yeah.
And so this listener said, just kind of confusing. So what about that? Yeah. And so I wanted to first start, even though Father John's not on the podcast, with Mary as our model.
Nice.
Mary is the ultimate contemplative. We read that she pondered all of these things in her heart.
That's right.
So throughout her life, from the very beginning, even before the Annunciation, there's this idea, this sense that she was there contemplating, pondering. She's already received the grace of the Immaculate Conception. She's reflecting on life. She's praying. She's prayerful. And she's waiting. She's waiting to hear. And so in this contemplative posture, awaiting God's action is where the angel Gabriel comes and speaks and says, this is your mission. So there's silence, contemplation, kind of the first mode is a waiting readiness, a discernment, listening for God, and then the response. But then once she's in this mission, there's a contemplating, an awareness, a readiness to sit back and meditate on what has happened, what she has seen, what Jesus has spoken, what he did as a child, what he does in his public ministry. She's always there seeing what he's doing and contemplating.
But can I make a comment about
please,
that?
Please, please, please.
That early on, the encounter with God and the theophany, like the appearance of God in some of the other gospels has, or in other stories, has like Joseph dreaming. Mm-hmm. He's got to be sleeping. He's in this other mode, you know, with consciousness. And then Zechariah in the temple, you know, the place is filled with the incense at the mm-hmm. time of the incense offering. It's like a sacred place. There's all these special circumstances and contexts. And Mary is just there, you know, mm-hmm. a young woman who is obviously in a place personally that is open to that experience, even though she's awake and mm-hmm. conscious and in the humble, ordinary place yeah. of her home in Nazareth. So there's an inward kind of disposition that is that open door to this wild supernatural realm, you know, mm-hmm. that allows that angel Gabriel to come in. And a lot of the Old Testament theophanies happen in these weird circumstances of sleep or kind of ecstatic prayer as well. So there's something very special just in the description mm-hmm. of Mary and this kind of simple contemplation.
Yeah. Yeah. And with the topic of Mary's simplicity in the contemplation, especially to the question of married Catholics, married Christians within the church, what's their role? Does the church want them around? The answer, simple, yes.
Yeah.
You're awesome.
Yeah.
We're going to look a little bit here at Lumen Gentium in a minute, where they kind of talk about the universal call to holiness. Mm. Because there was a time historically where the evangelical councils of poverty, chastity, and obedience were for the religious, and then everybody else was just kind of like baptized, and you go to confession and receive communion once a year, and you kind of abide by the liturgical year and celebrations and whatnot. But it was kind of like the project of religion was for the religious, and then mm-hmm. the kind of the lay faithful were, yeah, they're just kind of there. And so there is
you can
a
see
bit
that
of a disconnect.
Reflected in the saints, you know, the virgins and martyrs mm-hmm. are kind of the holy ones. And then the lay people, I don't know, for lack of a better word, it's not just that, but, are meant to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's holy and then there's good. And, there's good. And that's not it. Like, you know, nowhere explicit, but
it's kind of the sense kind of picked up. And a part of that is, I think, the way that saints are canonized. So canonization as a saint in the Catholic Church is declaring that this person is in heaven. Kind of the church has declared through the witness of life, through the witness of miracles, through their prayerful intercession, this person's clearly united with God. If they can, miracles happen through their intercession type of thing.
Can I add to that? Because I think there's, there's something, well, just that canon technically is a list.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that you, canonization technically is that you can, you're put on a list where you have a day for public veneration. Yeah. And celebration. So you have a feast or a memorial. And so it's not a claim in any radical way that everybody else is not in heaven.
Exactly.
And these are the only people in heaven. It's just that these have a special place in the liturgical celebration of the church at large.
Mm-hmm. And as a model of sanctity and someone who is worthy of being listened to in whether maybe their writings or their preaching, their model of life shows sanctity. And that's what the church is offering in the saints, is models for us to live by. So I understand the question totally of like, well, what are we supposed to do? I don't see a lot of married saints. Now, it was Louis and Zélie Martin were the first,
that's what I thought.
Were the first saints canonized as a married couple together, canonized together. I can't remember if there were other married saints that were canonized at separate times, but they were definitely, they were canonized together as saints, which is really cool and is a model.
And there's lots of married saints, Monica, Elizabeth of Hungary, there's countless.
You've got, I mean, some of the kings that became saints, or Queen Elizabeth, or, you know, they're obviously married as well. So
St. Thomas More is one of my faves.
Yeah, so these lay married saints, now they weren't canonized as a couple, kind of explicitly pointing to their marriage as a mode of imitation, but they were married and saintly.
And often enough, although this is not an absolute, they, after a spouse died, they went into like a convent or religious life. And so they're still kind of like, you know, during the family life, it's just getting by and trying not to bicker too much.
Yeah. Or you have the order of widows afterwards to kind of support the church or pray for the church and the church's needs. So I think, there might be a little bit of a confusion there, a disconnect there. But what Paul's saying is he's declaring this great good he has found, this unity with Christ to go off on mission to proclaim, and he's inviting. He's inviting to this life, this radical discipleship. And then the phrase of like, but if you're not able to, I guess you can get married, kind of gets read as like, if you're not up for it, if you can't actually be holy, you know, your chops aren't there as sure, whatever, you can go. But the church holds it as a sacrament, the sacrament of marriage, which is an image of the love of God for man, this permanent, undying covenantal love. And so the church,
and Paul, remember, is living the kind of radical life as a missionary that's very itinerant. You know, he's moving from community to community. He's suffering a lot of persecution and almost like turning into the curve.
Yeah.
And that's just not appropriate to bring your family into.
At the time of such intense persecution, is this the time to enter, you know, the family state?
Or just like that radical mission life. I know there are a lot of missionary families, and that's beautiful, but for a lot, it's not necessarily prudent. So there are different ways of being Catholic. Now, that's not to say that there's an opportunity for holiness and not, because I think where you're going, or where we're going to go with Lumen Gentium, is that you can pursue holiness and be holy within any state of life. It doesn't require that you're a missionary. It doesn't require that you're kind of living martyrdom all the time. That's not the definition of holiness. Yeah. But he was recruiting, and he needed some, you know, wild collaborators.
Some other ones, just before we jump back in the topic, St. John of Bretomola. Mm-hmm. Married, you know, saint, lived a saintly life with her husband. She was generous to the poor as a doctor. Just many, many Christian virtues on display in her, in both her kind of professional work, but as a wife and mother. Scrolling through some others. This quote from John Paul II. that he reminds married couples the holiness and the goal of their marriage. He says, "Today we have distinctive confirmation that the path of holiness lived together as a couple is possible, beautiful, extraordinarily fruitful, mm-hmm. and fundamental for the good of the family, the church, and society." And we talk about at the seminary that Father Leonard, the rector, loves to say the first seminary is the family. Mm-hmm. The first seedbed of vocation is the family. We are called to proclaim the gospel to all nations. That's not just Paul traveling. That's every married couple proclaiming it to their children.
That's right.
You're the first evangelist to your child.
And the most significant, by far, in every case. And I think in our time, it might be most important in the whole life of the church, the family, you know, the cohesion of a family, the love of it. In a family, the faith lived in a family, in a time and a place, at least where we are, that has so much brokenness in family. Mm-hmm. And it has an effect on society, has an effect on the church that's profoundly sad. Yeah. And so to live holiness, to live Christian charity and a profound love inspired by God is, and grounded in the community, the communion with the Holy Spirit and Christ and the Father, just the Trinitarian communion, is maybe like an especially important reality right now. And I think John Paul made a point of that, Second Vatican Council. Mm-hmm. It's a modern phenomenon that we live in a world that needs family, needs holiness in family.
Yeah. So to rewind back to Mary mm-hmm. now, and to tie it in with this contemplation or the contemplative life, there are orders, religious orders, kind of devoted to the contemplative mode of life. They enter into silence, they enter into the wilderness, so as to listen, to hear. Thomas Merton has a poem about John the Baptist that calls him the anchorite in his cell, in his mother's womb, waiting to hear the coming of Jesus, and then he leaps for joy. And so
a hermit, yeah, anchorite.
Anchorite is kind of tied into a small cell and like never even leaves their cell. Mm. And a hermit goes out to, you know, I think Thomas Merton was a hermit for a while, where he was just in kind of this small room, kind of house, hut, hermitage, praying and writing and thinking and waiting. The contemplative orders have kind of always been that that out of normal society, I don't want to say visionary, a century, waiting to see, waiting to hear, and then to proclaim and rejoice, to be the first to meet Christ's coming. There's been that image of the contemplative life, especially the hermits, being out waiting to light the fires of the beacon that Christ is coming. I think of the scene from Lord of the Rings where they light the beacons between Gondor and Rohan, and you see these people who are on these little waypoints in a little hut. Just their job is to look and wait, and if they see the beacon from before, you know, to their left or right, they light theirs so that the message can get spread and keep going. And so, on a spiritual level, the contemplative vocation is this looking, waiting, hearing, and then sending up the signal, and then another will take it up. And it's kind of this hidden, secret beating heart of the church. And so that's wonderful. But does that mean contemplation is only for a Carthusian or a Carmelite or a Benedictine? Or
yeah, what about describing some of these orders?
Yeah,
because you have the hermits that sort of set a tone, and historically that was kind of the first movement, and then they become more connected in communities.
Yeah, it's kind of historically the Desert Fathers were the first, the ones that kind of went off to the wilderness, right. And they kind of lived themselves a hermit life, and then they kind of band into these what would become the monasteries. So Benedict then kind of writes the rule of the monastery and how they live in common life, praying and working.
Yeah, and I think if you characterize the Christian life as one foot in on the earth and one foot in heaven kind of image, the idea of contemplative life as like a vocation is to spend life in the spiritual realm, mm-hmm. and with absolute dedication. There's a phrase, fuga mundi, where you flee the world. And that's used both positively and negatively in common parlance. But it makes sense that you're living a life entirely dedicated to Christ in a way that, and to heaven, like being in the spiritual realm, and in a way that isn't like the other missions where you're encountering people called to evangelize the same way, just to be communal, mm-hmm. you know. Although now we're going to move into, you know, communal life.
And that's the Benedictines, kind of the monastery is built, the Carthusians, Carmelites, kind of in this monastery model, kind of dominated the early part of the kind of church's religious life expression, modeled around the rhythm of prayer. Hours throughout the day, they would stop and they would pray around the Mass as kind of the central moment of the day, and then their work apart from that, and different degrees of ascetical practice or austerity. Some were entirely silent except for the liturgies. Some, you know, have some time for...
I think Carthusians are, aren't yeah. they? Mm-hmm. Entirely silent?
Yeah, they're silent. I think there's the film Into Great Silence, which
super cool.
Depicts the Carthusian community.
And it draws you into the silence.
And it's cool. Yeah, the film itself is silent. My favorite scene, you see this little monk run in and he like jumps up excited and he grabs the bell rope and just starts ringing the bell. And the film has been silent other than, you know, normal kind of nature sounds, not added, but from just what was filmed. And then the bell rings and you get this ding, ding. And
it's time.
So the sound, the call, the noise, if you want to call it that, is actually a call. A call to prayer, a call to the Mass. So,
the Western monastic tradition comes from the rule of Saint Benedict, and so these groups, these contemplative orders and monasteries, are built around a rule of life. So they have kind of simple rules that organize how the monks or nuns are meant to relate to each other, and rules about silence, rules about timing of when things happen, how to relate to guests and people visiting. So that's worth checking out. The Rule of Saint Benedict is real short, and it's well worth kind of learning, even kind of learning how to structure one's own life according to a rule. Also, Saint Augustine has a rule for his early kind of monastic community.
Yeah. And then we jump forward and we start getting what are called the mendicant orders, right? So the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the Jesuits, these orders that are out and active. So we start getting this kind of distinction between the active and the contemplative orders, which is a fine distinction, but kind of it's not that they're not praying. You know, Dominicans are there to preach, and so they study and pray so that they can preach, but they have a very rich prayer life and tradition along their method of praying the different hours together and as a contemplative practice, ready to then proclaim the gospel, that their whole life is now being infused by their mode of prayer so that they can go out and proclaim. And then they have become the kind of the studious order, the order of St. Thomas Aquinas. And so they're masterful preachers, they're teachers, they're defenders of doctrine. And so there's a bit of a distinction here, but it's like because they weren't strictly tied to this monastery kind of flaw. They would go traveling and preaching and teaching. Especially
you hear contemplatives in action, these kinds of things.
And especially the Franciscans were, you know, wandering preachers and begging and assisting the poor and being poor themselves. And so that distinction, I think, is fine. But
with a serious attempt to ground your life in the spiritual life.
The spiritual life and still a community with your brothers. And so I think it's a fine distinction, but I think I just want to point out that we start kind of labeling this distinction between, oh, well, we're active, and you're the contemplatives over there.
Right.
And I think
and that's important to see the drift.
Yeah.
That even leads to this kind of question of the family and where they land as... Are you in the world or are you in the, you know,
exactly
in the spiritual realm?
And can you be prayerful or contemplative if you're not one of these people? Because you're not a contemplative order. And my answer is, of course you can.
Yeah. Can I, is it too, is it going to tangent to ask you, have you ever spent any time in a monastery?
I spent 4 days at the Benedictine Monastery in Norcia after the earthquake. They had a big earthquake there that kind of, the basilica and their monastery kind of crumbled in. And they were already building a monastery up the valley out of, they'd got a plot of land. They were building a more permanent monastery up there. So they ended up moving up there. But when I got out there, it was very rustic still.
Yeah.
And they actually had like these storage container living units were the guest cells. So they had their principal building that they'd built up for the monks' quarters. But I was just in this like storage container.
Does it have holes unit. To breathe?
Yeah, it's just got a door on it. Nice. But they like, it's honestly, it's what the aid organizations will drop after natural disasters.
Oh,
so
yeah.
When housing has been destroyed, they've got, because you can just stack them on each other and send them on a ship and then, you know, unload them and take them where they need to be.
So they just found one and brought it up the hill?
So I think they got some. From probably because
the earthquake.
It was after a natural disaster.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So they got some and they got them delivered up there. I think they had two or three.
Oh, that's funny.
So I stayed with them. So it was really interesting. I was working with them, kind of doing some of the, well, I was cleaning up trash around the construction site and then I was building a retaining wall to kind of help against mudslide stuff. And
nice.
I can't remember the monk's name, but we're literally just wheelbarrowing back these loads of rocks and then building up retaining walls. And he just goes, I don't know why anybody needs a CrossFit membership. Why do you go to a gym? Just go build a retaining wall. It's way better.
See, monks know CrossFit. So that's a Benedictine monastery.
That's Benedictine monastery.
In Italy, it's where Benedict and Scholastica, where they grew up.
Yep. And so I spent, but then just joining them in their prayer rhythm. I didn't ever wake up for their 3 a.m. call to prayer. I slept through that one every time. But
one interesting thing about the monastery at Norcia is that they have a kind of outreach or ministry to families. Mm. Yeah, they have families that come in. When I was there, they had a meeting of families that came in for some Benedictine prayer and for some teaching from the monks. Yeah. And so they could sort of show their kids what monastic rhythm is like and see the monks in choir. And now that would be the role of, say the community is 20, that would be the role of a couple of monks.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like that's the whole mission. You know, they're grounded in their prayer and their rhythm of prayer and work. But, you know, if you're interested, there are some monasteries who not only welcome families, but in fact appeal to forming families.
And then it's the like the third orders, the tertiary orders, often with a lot of these groups are lay or couples kind of joining.
Yeah.
Taking on the spirit of the founder, the spirituality of Francis or Dominic or Ignatius or wherever it may be, and kind of living within, bringing it that spiritual expression into the day-to-day life of their family.
Yeah.
And that's been going on for forever too.
Yeah, and anybody can pursue the third order. So you become formally attached to that monastery or order and take on a rule, of life. Not every order has them, but take on a rule of life for your regular life.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to kind of highlight there's this maybe dividing now between their expression of active contemplative. And I think that is somewhat what contributed to, oh, well, then the religious are the ones that take on these vows. And so they're the holy ones and everybody else just kind of goes along. They're be generally good and, you know, that's fine. And I think that's just, we need to fight against that, that drift because I don't think there's actually ever been a time where you didn't have sanctity, immense sanctity within families and also the potential for immense vice and immense destruction. Likewise, within these religious orders, within these contemplative orders, there's been a lot of sanctity and there's been a lot of vice and a lot of corruption. And all of these orders, we've got different orders oftentimes because there were renewal efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that was kind of a break and a new expression with a new monastery. Sometimes it was within the community itself. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila are reformers of the Carmelite order. And they weren't very welcomed because the communities they were in at the time weren't too keen on getting back to the rule of life. They had kind of fallen into a little more of a lax expression and even into maybe vice. And so there's always a need for reform, sanctity in all life, and there's always been an opportunity for holiness in any state of life.
And contemplation. I think part of the craft of our time, and a call from the Second Vatican Council, and just kind of repeated expression from leadership in the church, that a call to sort of formulate and understand what contemplation can look like in domestic life. So that's still an ongoing project, but it's certainly something that's possible and encouraged. It's kind of necessary for the Christian life.
Which, that's a good transition into Lumen Gentium. I was going to read a little bit more, but maybe just kind of a survey. In paragraph 39 of the document, and Lumen Gentium is one of the main documents that came out of the Second Vatican Council.
Dogmatic Constitution on the Church.
On the Church, promulgated in 1964. So this is the Vatican Council II's dogmatic constitution on what is the Church, what does she look like, what are her members. We are all different members of the one body. So how does this work? How does this look? So in paragraph 39, we start talking about this universal call to holiness, which is the Church responding to this drift of, well, we've got our contemplatives, we've got our really holy people, our saints, and then kind of everybody else. Yeah. It's like a recall. No, like by your baptismal character, by your baptismal promises, by the faith that you have received, by the power of the Holy Spirit, you are to sanctify the world, everybody, and you're to grow in sanctity yourself. And I think we talked about this canonization of saints, where they're put in this list, this canon. Most of them were really well known because they were preachers, teachers, theologians, priests who had, you know, their parish. And so when they die, they're held up as this model, and they're the cult around them. The group that says this is a person worthy of reverence and honor, that's how a saint's cause kind of starts. They're known.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a lot easier when, you know, you're a missionary priest and you've evangelized all these people and everybody can point to him and say, look at that guy, look at that
you're
guy.
Right. He's got the spotlight.
Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, not a priest, also not married. His family, the people in Turin, didn't know the work he was doing with the poor until his funeral. And all the poor, these families that he had gotten to know when he was going and helping and serving and assisting, came out in mass to celebrate his funeral, but also like grieve. And people are like, where did this come from? Mm. And it's like, oh, these people, he was living a saintly life in assistance to these people, and they loved him, and he loved them. And we see that after his death only. But sometimes in a family, you live a very hidden, very quiet life of sanctity. There's not that crowd to raise up, oh, here's the cause for, you know, whoever it might be. Louis and Zelie Martin are interesting because they have multiple saintly children canonized or in the process. So they're well known as parents of saints. But that, I think, is another thing that is just the way they've been canonized, put in the canon and the list of saints. They were martyrs, or they kind of had this group around them that said this is a saintly person. And I think just naturally the family doesn't dispose itself to more of this public image or vision, right? And so you've got a lot of the other married saints were these kind of more political public figures, St. Thomas More, kings or queens or princesses or whatever it might be. Does that mean that there weren't saintly married people before then? No. And that's why the Church gives us the wonderful feast of All Saints. Solemnity, one of the highest feasts, because the Church is saying it's not just this canon. This is, we're celebrating all saints, and that all are destined to this sanctity, this sainthood.
And there's something even more appropriate, it seems to me, about the hidden life. Yeah. I mean, Mary gets attention at the beginning of the Gospels, and then, you know, at the foot of the cross, and at Pentecost. But she's not really spotlighted in a lot of it, and then you get so much attention on the apostles, but she's still the paradigm of holiness. So I think there's something appropriate about keep it small. You know, you're gonna become holier in any state of life if you're not trying to get the glam. You know, if you're seeking the glory, if you're seeking attention, if you want people to know how great you are as a Christian, then you're kind of setting yourself up.
Not the right track.
Yeah.
So just moving into Lumen Gentium, paragraph 41 begins with, "The classes and duties of life are many, but holiness is one. That sanctity which is cultivated by all who are moved by the Spirit of God and who obey the voice of the Father and worship God the Father in spirit and in truth." So we all have different duties, responsibilities of life, but holiness is one. Moved by the Holy Spirit to glorify God, listen to the Father. And then it gives us the kind of the listing of the role, the duties that they have. And so we start with the bishop. Most holily, which I loved, they made holy.
Is that holily? A verb,
holily, and eagerly, humbly, and courageously carry out their ministry, imitation of the eternal high priest, shepherd and guardian of our souls. They ought to fulfill this duty in such a way that it will be the principal means also of their own sanctification. Mm. So the bishop, and St. Thomas, commenting on the letters to Timothy and Titus, talks about it's kind of Paul's directive to the bishops, how to be bishops. And St. Thomas pulls out that bishops ought to have actualized in their life the fullness of the life of grace. And they are able then to actualize that in others through teaching, through the sacraments, through the proclamation of the gospel. So the bishop's principal role as united to a territory, a diocese, is to live in sanctifying grace and awaken that and stir that up in his people as an image of the high priest, Jesus Christ. Below that, we have the priests who receive their participation in the priesthood through the bishop. The bishops are successors of the apostles who have received their priesthood from Jesus Christ. The priests receive orders tied to a bishop and tied to a territory. So the bishop kind of is the image of Christ, the image of the groom. And then the priest is more of the friend of the bridegroom. The apostle is going out to assist, to help. Well, another image I liked was there's a shepherd, and then the priest is kind of like the sheepdog. Gets to go out and do the work.
Corral.
And so the priests are supposed to resemble the bishop, which means the bishop is giving the priests his vision for the diocese, hopefully from this place of prayer and contemplation and discernment, so that then the presbyterate is unified to look like the bishop. And so when the priest is out at the parish, it shouldn't be different than the bishop. And so it's actually a great tragedy when we see bishops warring against each other and then priests warring against bishops. It's actually showing a breakdown in the unity in the image. Now, the bishops have a right and a responsibility to kind of check in with each other and make sure they're on the right track. This goes back to Acts of the Apostles. This goes back to Paul and Peter. And Paul comes in and says, "Hey, Peter, this wasn't cool. I think you need to do it this way." And this wasn't like on CNN, like live news, Paul beats down Peter. And, you know, because that's what we're doing in church now. It's like, this bishop is saying this about this bishop, and this bishop saying this about the Pope. It's like, Peter and Paul, they had their meeting, and assuming it was face-to-face or one or two, and it was the College of Apostles doing this. And then later, for pastoral need, showing the people, Paul writes this saying, like, I even had to do this with Peter, and you should go do this in this way. Go first yourself, and then two, and then, you know, more. So,
and he's showing the collaboration.
And then it's this reception. It's this collaboration between the College of Bishops towards the truth. And then we have this unity. So the priests are following in that. And then you have your...
So part of this vision, or the vision, is being set that everyone is within this common vocation of following Christ, being sanctified by the graces of baptism. And then there's these different roles that come up. Can I use that word, role?
I think roles, responsibilities. It's like
how to serve, not...
duties, not like state of life.
These guys should be the saints, and then sort of whatever.
And so then we have other ministers, deacons, and now we've got, you know, orders, offices, not orders anymore, but kind of the, you become a lector and an acolyte with a kind of particular mission on your way towards the priesthood, towards the clerical life. And they have a way of serving. That's a whole other podcast another time.
Yeah.
And then you get into the religious. Religious have kind of their mode. We talked about that kind of early at the beginning. And they take on the counsels, poverty, chastity, and obedience in a vow, which they make to God, consecration of themselves to God. And they're a witness and a model to the life, ultimately to heaven. We call it an eschatological witness of we will all be united in totality, giving everything to the Father in the poverty, chastity, and obedience. And then it ends with married couples. And it says, furthermore, married couples, which sounds a little bit like, and then we got the married couples again, right? But furthermore, married couples and Christian parents should follow their own proper path to holiness by faithful love. They should sustain one another in grace through the entire length of their lives, supporting each other in grace, praying for each other, interceding, bearing patiently with each other. Then they should imbue their offspring lovingly, welcomed as God's gift, with Christian doctrine and the evangelical virtues. This is the teaching office, the teaching role of the families to the children. This is where you're the evangelist, the teacher. Christ, who calls himself teacher, he is the one teacher. Mm. Parents participate just as bishops are teacher in teaching the sacred doctrine. Parents are the teacher to their children. So God loves the structure of order flowing down in subsidiarity, flowing from the Father, you know, to the Son, through the Holy Spirit to the church, from the bishops through the priests to the deacons who go out to serve, you know, and then to the married couples who can give it to their children, and we raise up this next generation of faith. At the rite of baptism, we tell people, or we tell the, ask the couple, are you ready to accept this obligation to teach and educate and raise your child in the faith? So there's an obligation, and the child has a right to education in the faith, and that's the role of the married couples.
Yeah, if holiness is defined in part by conformity to Christ, what you're hearing described here is in some way the way that Jesus relates to the church and the world, you know, as teacher, as sustainer, as guide, as the one who loves us into holiness, as spouses do, and as, you know, the family does, parents and children, children and parents. This is holiness. That's what a saint looks like. You know, this trying to draw this picture of this. If you want to know, you know, should this person be canonized? It might be too early to canonize your, you know, your child or your spouse or whatever. But that is sanctity. That is holiness. It's not like wait for miracles to be done so much as it's the exercise, life lived in divine charity and conformity to Jesus.
And I think at the end, what I love and what I want to draw our attention to as we close is the church says, for those who engage in labor, they should better themselves by their human labors. That our labor, our work itself, just as the Benedictines find sanctity through prayer and work, or at labora, in our state of life, we're supposed to raise our, or grow in virtue, bettering ourselves through our human labors. They should be of, we citizens, fellow lay Catholics, should be of aid to their fellow citizens. They should raise all of society and even creation itself to a better mode of existence. Indeed, they should imitate by their lively charity and their joyous hope and by their voluntary sharing of each other's burdens, the very Christ who plied his hands with carpenter's tools and who in union with his Father is continually working for the salvation of all men. In this, then, their daily work, they should climb to the heights of holiness and apostolic activity. And so what I offer, just as the church has told the bishop a few paragraphs before, that through his teaching, through his living a perfection of charity and awakening that in his people, he is sanctified. Your work, whatever you are doing, wherever you are, insurance adjuster, a carpenter, a HVAC installer, a professor, through your work, through faithfulness to your work, through doing your work honestly better than anybody else, not for personal private gain, not for pride or prestige, but for the glory of God, like, Christians should be seen as like the best at what we do, because what we're doing glorifies God. And so I just want to kind of speak against a tendency at times where we think, even maybe as lay people, oh, to be holy, I have to be like Francis or Benedict or Dominic or Ignatius or St. Paul. That's the only way to holiness. And the church is saying, no, your way to holiness is through your state of life. And so we've got this order, you know, bishops, priests, deacons, married people, you know, non-married people. Here's the order. Mm. Well, the vocation to the priesthood and the vocation to religious or to marriage are called missional vocations. They are at the service of the church. They're at the service of others. They are to raise faith in others, to support, to serve. They're not for themselves in the end. And so the marriage is at the service of the children and then the local community around the parish community. And when we work, and that is our sanctification. So the bishop has his role and his responsibility. And if he doesn't do that well, if the bishop kind of does some administrative stuff over here and then has his private life where he's trying to live like a CEO and kind of has his own little projects and things, and it's not really what the church has asked him to do, that's not going to sanctify him. Well, just as the layman who might actually be the CEO of a company through his work, through the way he treats his employees and sells product of whatever it might be, he can glorify God in this. And if he tries to then run, if that's what he's called to do, which takes discernment, if he tries to run, like, actually, I need to spend 7 hours in the church because I need to be contemplative, well, that's not actually his state of life or his calling, his vocation. That won't actually sanctify him. So I think sometimes we think I need to flee my world, my work, sometimes my family, to be in the church. And we think of the church as just the building and the location. And I love that we have perpetual adoration in a lot of parishes. I think that's a great gift to the church. I think I've got some friends who are in this prayer group where they come together, they take on a holy hour to pray for their pastors. Like, it's a beautiful witness of the lay faithfuls seeking sanctity, supporting their parish, supporting their pastors. I'm not saying don't do that. Those are wonderful gifts. But don't think that your sanctity is apart from your marriage, is apart from your children, and is apart from whatever work you're doing. Loving your spouse, loving your children, mm-hmm. and teaching them about God, raising them in faith, teaching them virtue, practicing virtue yourself, which models it to your children, and then living that virtuous life in the world, which bears the burdens of others in work, is actually our path to sanctity. And so we all have a place, we all have a role, we all have work to do, and we need to be faithful to that work. So that's my soapbox at the end.
Oh, I love it. And the example that comes to my mind is Mother Teresa and her Contemplatives in Action. They have to spend a lot of time running around the streets to find people to change their diapers, and Mom doesn't. Mm-hmm. She just has to go to the next room or pick up the kid, and that's poverty. That's people in need of charity. And the missionaries of charity do their work out of love for people, but see this every act of love of a person as love for Jesus. They're loving Jesus when they, you know, change that diaper, when they care for that leper, when they house homeless women who are often shouting over here in Denver. And they love them as Jesus. And that's holiness, right? And I think there's a lot of opportunities within the family to see the same thing. How can I love Jesus in these people who have been given to me, have been given to me as a gift and as a vocation in, you know, in a very real sense? Call. God calls you every day to serve these people radically. A recommendation is Francis de Sales, The Devout Life. Mm-hmm. He goes in very early on to different states in life and explains something of what you've just said about you might not be called to run away from your, you know, put your kids in daycare and go to the church to pray. You might be called to that kind of charity that becomes busy. And it might not have as many opportunities for the kind of contemplative life that might feel more like holiness when you're spending time closing your eyes or, you know, contemplating God. So The Devout Life by Francis de Sales. And then finally, ground yourself in contemplation, but you have to be really creative, because I think we could spend this time bending over backward to say, Paul's wrong, you know, family life is just as easy to find holiness. And in part, it is harder with all the distractions of work and family and all of these things to have time for contemplative life and to have time to pray. Talk to any married couple. I have siblings who have all asked me, well, this is a challenge. I don't complain is the wrong word, but kind of like when I was single, I had a lot more time for prayer, and now I can't find it, or it's really hard to not be distracted, or I'm tired, or whatever it is. And that's just a reality. You know, I don't want to, I want to be able to encourage consecrated vocations, in part saying this will give you more opportunity to pray. If you find yourself to be the soul that needs contemplation, is made for contemplation, then seriously consider a consecrated life, a life as a monk or a nun in a convent. Or I'm not bragging, but I have more time to pray than other people do. And
yet, even as a priest, I hear some priests sometimes bemoan that, like, oh, I don't have as much time.
Sure.
When I was in seminary,
I'd want to be a monk.
I had so much time to pray, and now I've got all these tasks at the parish. But it's precisely through those tasks at the parish that we are sanctified as priests.
Yeah.
That caring for.
And I'm not called to be a monk.
Out of pastoral charity, you know? The people of the parish.
Yeah. And this is my way of holiness.
Exactly.
And this is my way of holiness since baptism. Mm. This is the path.
And just returning, I guess, to Mary, she gives us the model, actually, for every other Christian, whatever state of life you're in, of active and contemplative and service and prayer. And ultimately, we talk about this ordering of the vocations, right? And sometimes that gets misconstrued with better or worse. This is a higher vocation, therefore it's a better vocation. The best vocation is your vocation, what God has called you to do. That actually takes discernment and then action. And it's not this perpetual, oh, tell me, lightning strike, where do I go? It actually takes action. It takes stepping out, like you did at the end of the last podcast. Guys, if you're on the fence, don't do what I did, waiting 6 years, just go take the first step, right? And God's working and he's drawing you. If you're thinking about contemplative life, if you're thinking about consecrated life, take the first step. If you really feel that marriage is your calling, your vocation, take the first step. Go ask somebody out, or say yes to somebody who asks you out, whatever it might be. There's this action within the discernment of God's will. But then when we find and we rest in our vocation, that's now our path to holiness. And in that, we can be contemplative. And that's where Mary gives us this model of two things I think are incredibly important for contemplation and prayer and growth in the spiritual life. First, contemplation in the daily tasks. Mary is the most contemplative person ever to live. And guess what? She was prepping dinner for Joseph and Jesus, and she was cleaning up after Jesus. He was probably a way better son than I was, leaving my socks everywhere. Sorry, Mom.
But did they have socks?
I don't know. Leaving his sandals everywhere? I don't know. But Mary took care of the household. Mary took care of Joseph and Jesus as a mother. And Joseph took care of Jesus as a father. And Joseph worked as a craftsman. And Jesus worked with his hands. And through all of this, they're all contemplating God. They're contemplating what God is doing. Mary's contemplating these things in her heart as she's, you know, on the pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And where's Jesus? And everything's, he's lost. All of these times, she's a mother, but she's contemplative and she's prayerful. So this interior life, this mode of practicing the presence of God is another way to say it, is accessible to everybody, and we bring it into our life. Blessed Conchita of Mexico is another one who's kind of gaining some exposure for her writings, kind of a mystic, who is a mother of, I can't remember how many, but many children, wife and mother, who is a contemplative, who prayed, who served her family, who served her children, but was also like assisting with other orders being, you know, growing and interceding for priests and all this stuff. So that mode of contemplation is for everybody, but it is also within your state. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to offer.
We covered this in the last podcast, but it's worth doing now, is the 1 minute.
Yeah, the 30-second club.
30-second club.
So wake up in the morning.
Yep.
And pray. That's one right. minute. One Our Father, correct, you know, with, especially if you're married, with your spouse, that you're together as a team, husband and wife, mother and father. Today, we offer together to God, pray the Our Father. You're doing it together. You'll have great success with that. Yeah.
And you're grounding your life in, we're going to live by grace. Yeah. We're going to live by the Holy Spirit and let the Holy Spirit direct our life today.
And that moves me to, I just remembered, the second part was Mary, after receiving the Annunciation, after receiving Christ, conceiving him, what does she do? She runs to community. Mm. She runs to her cousin mm-hmm. to help take care of her, to serve her who's pregnant and needs help in the 6 month, but also to just rejoice together. And I think one of the great dangers to families is isolation and staying closed in my little bubble of mom, dad, 2, 3, 4, 5 kids, and we're just closed. We choke ourselves out that way. And I just encourage all priests to help their families be united together as families. And I encourage all families to reach out to other families, invite other families into your life, invite yourselves into other families' lives. Rejoice in the good things that you're contemplating in your families together with your extended family and with your local community, with other other parents. And in that communal life, we actually see others living this heroic life, and you see the virtue in the other that you might not see in yourself. And so just being in that community of witness, that cloud of witnesses, super important.
Beautiful. Well, I don't have any shout outs. I'm just going to go right into saying, your priests love you, families. And I do very strongly believe that holy families are going to save the world right now. And so know of my encouragement and excitement for you, hope for you. Trust that God is working. It's hard to give us ourselves judgment about where do I stand in sanctity. So just trust that the Lord is working there, and then be intentional about it. You're great. Stay holy. Whoever sent that question, yes, be saints.
Yeah. I'm going to shout out Father John Ignatius, because he's a priest who modeled to me service to families, to fathers first, to kind of teach fathers how to pray and lead their families in prayer. But then he's got this just beautiful network of men that were in Bible studies with him, that now they're living that Christian life together with these other families, kind of in a community, and they're doing awesome. So
praise
God, everybody. CatholicStuffPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for your prayers. We're praying for you. Thanks for listening.
Ciao.